budget. I went to the SRNL 10th anniversary celebration where both senators, Senator Scott and Senator Graham attended, which I thought was a really, spoke well of what the Congress thinks of the National Lab. Every year DOE puts on, DOE and its contractors put on a leadership forum, community leaders forum, just to bring the community up to date with what's going on. I went to that. I've gone to several CAB meetings, Citizens Advisory Board meetings. 2 weeks ago, Don and I and Shelley, David, the governor's office, and some other community leaders met with John McWilliams, who is special advisor to Moniz, I guess, to talk about a lot of things about Savannah Riverside. And he went back with a better understanding, I think, of how the SRS operates. And then finally, last week was the public meeting to collect scoping comments on the proposed German highly enriched uranium that may come to the site. Went to that. I did not speak, but I listened. The council is working on a letter, scoping comment letter that we will submit after this meeting. So, with that, thanks for coming. Steve, I will let you and Larry come up and... I'm sorry about the... It's like we don't have any air conditioning either.
So good afternoon, everybody. Thanks again for
do I have a pointer?
That is. Thanks for letting me come and give you an update on what's been happening with Duke Energy's nuclear program. And today I have brought Larry Haynes, who heads our scientific services group in Charlotte, to come as well, because one of the questions that we got in advance was, tell us a little bit about tritium. So Larry knows way more about tritium than you're going to want to hear about. But, I'm not sure this is on. Okay, I'll talk loud. I'll try to talk loud. So anyway, what we're going to talk about today is, first of all, an overview of our nuclear fleet, the operating units, the new units we have under development, and the one unit that's entering into decommissioning. It's been shut down. We're going to talk about the 2013 performance for the operating units, and we'll talk about some initiatives that we have for those. And then I'm going to turn it over to Larry, and he's going to talk about our groundwater protection program. So just as a reminder, our nuclear fleet consists in North and South Carolina of six sites, three in North Carolina, three in South Carolina. The South Carolina plants are Oconee, three units in the upstate area, Catawba, south of Charlotte, two units, and then Robinson, one unit. And all of them are pressurized water reactors. I just editorialize a little bit here just to remind people, nuclear power has been a great success story for Duke Energy since we started up. Our first unit came online in 1971 with Robinson, and it has become the backbone of our generation of electricity. And we've been able to provide economical electricity to the North and South Carolina region for decades as a result of these nuclear plants, and they're still going strong. Also, I'll mention again that Clemson University did a study that looked at the economic value of nuclear energy in the Carolinas, and they found that the total economic impact of nuclear in the Carolinas tops $20 billion, directly providing about 29,000 jobs. Houston, we have a problem. So I'm there.
Click click one more time as if to go to the next slide and see what happens.
Yeah, I've been doing that.
Okay, and what happens when you click on
that? I don't know. Let's see. I've got a thumb drive I can pull out if you want. Too many things in my pocket. There we go. All right. You know how to go full screen on this? Very good. Okay.
Oh, that's just for my camera. Yeah, I'm going to use the system, but since it's not working.
People who watch this on television will be able to
hear you. That's not good. So I believe I left off here. We have the six sites in North and South Carolina, and so let's talk for a minute about our new nuclear program. We have two plants in the licensing process now. Lee is in South Carolina near Gaffney, and Levy is in Florida, and our company also has service territories in Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, and Florida. And so Levy would come into service down in Florida and serve customers down there. Both of those are in the licensing process. We're looking at the Levy license probably in the time frame of 2015, and the Lee license we expect right now to get it about 2016. Working through some issues, none of which appear to be insurmountable. One is waste confidence, which I think you're aware of, has resulted in a moratorium on the NRC issuing new licenses and license renewals. But that's expected to be resolved in October of this year. We're going back and we've made some submittals on the impact of reevaluating seismic hazards in the central and eastern United States on the Lee plant. So the NRC is currently reviewing that, and there's also a design change to the AP1000 design associated with condensate return for emergency core cooling system that's also under review by the NRC right now. So as I said, as far as Lee is concerned, the current timetable would have us with the expectation of getting the license middle of 2016. Crystal River is the only nuclear plant we have in Florida, and it has been shut down permanently. We had damage occur to the containment shield building in 2009 following a steam generator replacement. We made the decision in early 2013 to shut the unit down rather than repair it. We're planning to put it in what's called safe store, which is basically it just sits there for a number of years, and then ultimately we'll decommission the plant. And we made some submittals to the NRC back in December of last year about our plans for decommissioning. And so the plant, there's really not a whole lot of activity going on the site right now. The big thing that's going to happen is we plan to put the spent fuel, take it out of the pool and put it in dry storage, and then at that point maintain the plant in safe store. So shifting back to the operating plants, just a look at the performance of the plants last year in 2013. So we track our performance a lot of different ways in the nuclear field, but one thing we do is we look at things we call key performance indicators, or KPIs, and they fall in the category of safety, reliability, and efficiency. They relate to things like dose and cost and availability and things of this nature. And we compare how our fleet does to how other fleets across the country stack up. So based on last year, we ended up fourth out of the nine fleets. So our goal is to be the best. So obviously we still have a little bit of work to do. But some highlights for 2013 before I talk about 2014. We had a capacity factor of nearly 93%. 15th year in a row we've had capacity factor greater than 90%. We have exceeded the U.S. industry nuclear capacity factor for the last 21 years, for the average, rather. Last summer, we had a fleet capacity factor approaching 100%, which is when we really need the power. Plant Robinson had a 531-day continuous run, which is a record for that plant. Oconee had a 552-day continuous run, also a record for that unit. And Oconee 3, a 504-day continuous run, a record. And the one that I take particular pride in, or our company does, is we had 315 days of continuous run for all three units at Oconee last year, which is a pretty impressive feat. And the station had a capacity factor of nearly 95%. So as I said, our goal is to continually to improve our performance, and we're focusing on four areas this year. Equipment reliability is one. I think the importance of equipment reliability is pretty obvious. Workforce sustainability, this is looking at kind of the people side of things and making sure we have the right people organized in the right way to get the work done. Outage execution, we think we can do a lot better at our refueling outages, which occur every 18 months or 2 years for some of the plants. And if we can get those into a shorter and more predictable mode, then we can further improve our performance there. And then financial stewardship, which we also call excellence in cost management. So that's a recognition that whereas electricity prices are not escalating dramatically these days, on average, our costs for running our nuclear plants has been going up, and we want to make sure that our units remain economical and the best value for generating electricity. So we're looking at how we can make sustainable improvements to our structures so that we can get the work done and do it even more efficiently than we are right now. So those are the four focus areas for this year. And that is all that I had to say about the general fleet update. So I think maybe let me entertain any questions that y'all might have before I turn it over to Larry about tritium. Dr. Cross.
Is your workforce continuing to age? Do you get enough younger people in there to tighten that off a little bit?
Well, it's we have had programs for years to try to address the aging workforce issue. And I think that, and I'll ask Larry to chime in if he wants to. You know, I think we're in a pretty good place, but it depends on what discipline you're talking about. So, as I tell people, the big challenge for us is not so much engineers, because we've hired a lot of engineers over the last decade, decade and a half. So we're moving people in to replace the folks that are aging out. A bigger challenge is the technicians, the people that go out in the plant and do the real work. Turn the valves and weld, and you know, the RP technicians and things like that. So that's where I think there's even a bigger challenge these days. It's just not a popular area for people to work in America today. But with all that being said, you know, we think we're in pretty good shape in that regard.
Maybe the light. Oh, there it goes. This pertains maybe to plants here. What is
the workforce for a
retired plant, where do they go? What do they? What options do they have?
Well, it depends. In the case of Crystal River, we did our best to place people at the site, and that involved in jobs at the reduced workforce that we have, maintaining the site until we complete decommissioning and finally shut it down, and also transferred a number of people to other parts of our company, and then where there were not other opportunities available, there were some layoffs.
Okay.
But we did. I don't have the stats on that, but we did a pretty good job of minimizing those.
Yeah, but with so many closings, it's going to get harder and harder to find places to put people. Yeah.
That is correct.
These are the focus areas where you think you need improvement. Is that you did your whenever you're.
We do a gap analysis every year.
You're fourth of nine, and this is where you need to improve.
Well, we need to improve everywhere. We're always looking for opportunities, but these are the four areas where we particularly call out with particular initiatives to try to address issues that we see.
And why is it more expensive? Why is, you know, the general consensus is, oh, it's cheaper to run nuclear plants once you get them built. So why is the cost of running a plant going up?
Well, it still is cheaper to produce electricity from a nuclear plant than any other source of electricity, with the exception of the fuel-free things like solar and wind, which of course are very, very expensive to build in the first place, but and which do not run around the clock. But the fuel is very, very cheap for nuclear plants, and that's why we have a cost advantage relative to coal and relative to natural gas and things like that. Nuclear is a pretty people-intensive enterprise to operate compared to a gas plant or a coal plant, so that part of the operating cost is higher. But you know, we're still, I mean, our electricity that we generate from nuclear is still the cheapest that we have. We dispatch it first, but we're just looking at trends, and we want to make sure that we keep things that way.
Thanks. Other questions? Okay, Mr. Haynes, I guess it's your turn. Thank you for coming and agreeing to do this. I appreciate that.
Okay. My little light doesn't work.
It's working. Yours is working.
I've got the low seat, I guess.
Yep.
glad you can hear me. I tend to have a low voice sometimes. I'm glad to come do this. And the question that Steve relayed to me was, we want to talk about our groundwater protection initiative at Duke Energy, and particularly a little bit about tritium to start with. We're really interested in all radionuclides, not just tritium, but tritium tends to be the one we see most often because it's so mobile in the groundwater. But we luckily we have not seen anything other than tritium in any of our sampling, so I'll go through that as we get through here. We have a groundwater initiative for the whole industry that all of nuclear power plants in the United States has committed to. Our chief nuclear officers committed to that back in 2006, and we put together this initiative. And following up with that was this underground piping and tank initiative. That is the intention of to prevent leaks and spills versus finding them in the groundwater in a monitoring well. So we kind of went backwards. We had some issues in the industry that brought it to our attention that we do have an issue sometimes with leaks and spills. Could impact groundwater. So we'll talk about NEI 0914. We did have an event at Oconee earlier this year. It was a leak from a pond, and I've got some pictures and drawings. We'll talk through that. And then just a general overview of Catawba and Robinson and Oconee's program here in the state, but the North Carolina plants have the same type programs. So I'm sure you're probably as aware of tritium, particularly with Savannah Riverside here in the state as I am. Tritium is just a radioactive isotope of hydrogen, and has a 12.5-year half-life. So once it's in the environment, it's really not something that will decay away very quickly, and you just have to basically wait it out. There's lots of mediation activities you can do, and the folks from Savannah River are talking a lot of detail about how they're managing some of the issues down there. Tritium, basically, as I said, is hydrogen. One proton, two neutrons makes it unstable. It's a radioactive atom. Tritium does occur naturally in the environment. It's activation and reactions in the atmosphere with nitrogen, basically. A small amount is produced. But most background activities we see in the United States or across the world is really from the old bomb testing, atmospheric testing was done back in the 60s. So that's readily detectable in the environment. Tritium is a very low energy beta activity, beta particle emitter. It's only 18.6 keV, so you really can't detect it with anything other than something like a liquid scintillation counter, which you actually put the sample inside of a scintillator and count it in a specially designed counter. The good thing about that is the only way it can really become a biological hazard would be if it's brought into the body through inhalation or absorption through the skin or drinking. So it's very difficult to really have any major exposure from tritium. But the EPA does have a drinking water standard for tritium, and that's 20,000 picocuries per liter. And a little bit there about what the units are. I'm not going to really talk too much about that. But the EPA standard is 4 millirem per year for tritium, but it's based on the way the regulation is written. It's 20,000 picocuries per liter. So if we use today's models, that 4 millirem in a year from 20,000 picocuries per liter is really 1.2 millirem. So it's the difference between ICRP2 models from 1959 versus the newer models, ICRP60, that's being used today, and then the newest ICRP data, ICRP103, just came out, and that data is being put together now, so we'll have some different conversion factors. The only reason I say that, I want to emphasize that it's not really 4 millirem per year. We use 20,000 because that is the EPA standard. But to get that dose, whatever it may be, you would have to drink 2 liters of water every day for a year to take that, have that much dose. So that's very, very good bit of water and very small amount of dose. Now for effluent releases from our plants or any other facility, we are allowed to release we call them batch releases, basically be a tank release under our permitted discharge pass up to 1 million picocuries per liter. But that would be into a water body and very, very diluted. So the standard for the drinking water is that the drinking water intake is where that would apply, where the samples are obtained. If you have any questions about this, please let me know as we go. And I know there's a lot of information there, and if you're not familiar with it, it may be somewhat confusing.
Let me ask you about
this. Okay, mine doesn't work. Oh, there it goes. Let me ask you about the batch releases. Do you hold it up until you have 1 million picocuries, or you just turn it loose when something else? How do you decide when your batch is ready to go?
Well, the batch is not based on the concentration.
Okay.
It's basically, we'll have a tank of water that we process from the plant, and we'll clean it up using demineralizers and filters. Tritium can't be removed.
Right.
It's basically water. So once we have the tank, this processed, and we'll make the release.
Thanks.
So there may be, depending on the plant, there may be, you know, 1 a week or so, and during an outage, maybe 2 weeks.
Right. And so your limit is 1 million, but that's not necessarily what you're releasing.
Right, it's usually lower than that. That's,
yep,
that's the upper bound of what,
yep,
we're allowed to do. Since there are all of the Duke plants in South Carolina are PWRs, we'll talk a little bit about pressurized water reactors. We use boron to help control reactivity in the plant. So at the beginning of the fuel cycle, we've got a lot of boron in there to manage the high reactivity of the cores. That boron undergoes reactions and activation reactions with neutrons, which can produce the tritium. So that's why we have most of the tritium show up in our plants. Toward the end of the cycle, it's a lot lower. About 90% of the tritium comes from that particular mechanism. 10% is produced by ternary fission, and And I'd say mostly there from the byproducts of some of the fission products with lithium and other boron that is produced just as part of the reaction that takes place. So for a BWR, that 10% is the part that we would see like down at Brunswick. Any questions about that? Okay, enough about tritium. So the NEI 0707 is the groundwater protection initiative that I mentioned that our chief nuclear officer is committed to back in 2006. What we committed to was to, I'll start back. It started with a leak at the Braidwood station in Illinois, where they have a blowdown line that runs from the plant from the cooling towers, and they had a vacuum breaker that had failed and leaked water onto the ground, and they found it in a well in a nearby farm. It became a big issue. It was mostly an issue because the locals around that plant were using shallow wells for drinking water that had other issues from pesticides and things from farming. So it became a way to elevate some of the concerns they had about those items and brought this into it. But for the industry, it became an issue of transparency and making sure that we as operators of the plant are being open with the public. That problem at Braidwood revealed that people really didn't understand our operations and how they could impact the environment and the folks around the plants. So this initiative was a commitment to ourselves and to the NRC and to the public that we would voluntarily communicate anytime we found anything from a leak or a spill in the groundwater, or even a leak or a spill. So we committed to install monitoring wells around our plants. We did hydrogeological studies to determine the groundwater flow directions. We looked at how it flows around the plant, how things like new construction could affect the groundwater flow, and then where that water would end up if it did migrate off-site. We committed if we saw, when we use the drinking water number as our trigger for a well sample, that if we detected anything at 20,000 picocuries per liter or greater, that we would communicate that to the public and our stakeholders. So our calls would go to our local states and county stakeholders and, of course, to the NRC. And then we typically would make press releases to go with that to make sure that the public is informed. Then the other half of that is the manage leaks and spills. So our objective is to not have to make communications because we've had leaks or spills and found it in the groundwater. We want to prevent them to start with. So we made the commitment there that if we have a leak or spill that has any potential to reach the groundwater, and it's any detectable activity, there's no bottom level to it, and more than 100 gallons of water, we're going to go make a communication to our local stakeholders. So following the NEI 0707, the folks having to do all the monitoring and deal with the monitoring wells and make the communications, we said, how do we really go about preventing leaks and spills to start with? So the initiative for underground piping and tanks was put together in 2009. And the goal of that, I'll just read that piece to you and not the whole slide, but provide reasonable assurance of structures, of structural and leakage integrity of in-scope underground piping and tanks with special emphasis on piping and tanks that contain licensed or radioactive material. The other piece of that are things like diesel fuel and other environmentally problematic things if you have a leak. So part of that initiative is making sure our cathodic protection programs that protect the pipes are in really good shape. Inspections have been done on all of our piping systems around the plant. There were some timelines associated with when those inspections had to be done. If you found indications, what had to happen once those indications were found as far as additional inspections and then repairs. Included in that would maybe be replacing some pipe that could be a problem. So any questions about those two initiatives before I move on to O'Connor?
I do. I have This is an industry initiative, so I assume it's sort of voluntary. Does NRC has NRC got regulations for monitoring and surveilling your pipes? Or is this just the industry initiative?
Well, this is our commitment, industry voluntary initiative, yeah, for leaks and spills and just type things. But the NRC does regulate the way we manage our